Welcome to Sports Wise, a podcast about sports and the law with your host, me, Gabe Feldman, director of the Tulane Sports Law Program and co-director of the Tulane Center for Sport. On this episode, I'm joined by Casey Schwab, CEO and founding partner of Altius Sports Partners, to talk about the recent decision by a federal judge that enjoined the NCAA from enforcing its restrictions on using NIL as a recruiting inducement by collectives and third parties. Casey helps me break down what the case means for the future of college sports. Here we go. Quick things before I get to the interview with Casey. First, there was something horribly wrong with my microphone when we recorded this interview, so my sound sounds terrible. So I apologize, but just bear with it because the content is really good. You can't hear my jokes as well as you normally could, but Casey's jokes are good, and again, the content is great. And then two, this is the first of a two-parter. Casey and I also discuss private equity and college sports. But because the Tennessee discussion was so interesting and lasted so long, I'm going to post the private equity discussion as a second part. So now on to the interview. Welcome to the podcast, Casey Schwab. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Gabe. Talk to you quite a bit, but usually without people listening to us. So I'm excited to have the three listeners that listen to your podcast, listen to your two kids and your wife listening to us have a conversation.
Well, thank you for that. Casey, we have a lot to talk about, only some of which is relevant for this podcast. But for the podcast, we were going to talk about private equity in college sports and what that meant for the future of college sports. We still are going to talk about that. We did talk about that. We've recorded that. But we now have the breaking... We're not breaking news right now. This has happened 3 days ago. But we got the big decision in Tennessee around NIL. And you and I and many others in this industry have been studying this and trying to figure out what this means now for 96 hours or 120 hours.
I think we've been thinking about it for several years, but not this specifically. But yeah.
So I want to do two things. One is talk about what the injunction means and doesn't mean, what it allows and doesn't allow, and then give an inside look at how you, as the CEO of Altius Sports Partners, dealt with this news and how you communicated with the different schools that you work with.
We should add one in the front, because breaking news is relative because time is relative. So you said you weren't sure if this was breaking news. It could be actually breaking some news, depending on your definition of time. But seriously, thank you for having me. Again, as you alluded to, we had a conversation, which I thought was mildly interesting. And now we're going to have another conversation over top of it. But in all seriousness, this podcast, which we started talking about private equity a week ago, and now we're coming back on and having a conversation about a development in the last 4 days, 3 days, just goes, I think it's a microcosm of college athletics right now and how quickly it's changing, which is the reason that Altius Sports exists. And I think in large part, our value is being able to provide, if not real time, fake time. That's a Gabe Feldman joke, everybody. But close to real time analysis, guidance, and then most importantly, recommended action items for athletics directors and folks on campus. So that's my lead-in pitch for Altius Sports Partners.
Before we get into the injunction itself, you mentioned this is a microcosm. Is it possible it's also a macrocosm?
Are there chasms?
It could be. People don't talk about macrocosms.
I'm currently whelmed by this portion of the conversation.
All right. So let's do a shallow jump into the injunction that was handed down by Eastern District of Tennessee.
For sure. And then we'll get to the high-hanging fruit after that. Look, so at its highest level, the injunction that was issued in Tennessee is highest level is very narrow. And the most specific way I can say it is that the NCAA is no longer allowed to prohibit collectives from negotiating and offering NIL deals to recruits. Okay. So go ahead.
No, but let's set for the context. There are a lot of people who listen who are following this minute by minute. There are others that are following it kind of month by month. So the ruling, obviously, then you just said the specifics are really important, but what does it allow that it wasn't allowed before, and what might change because of the ruling?
Yeah. The idea of the use of name, image, and likeness deals, aka commercial deals for sponsorship, licensing, social media, or using NIL deals and what I call synthetic NIL deals as a pathway for pay for play, which is using a commercial deal with an athlete or a recruit that you want to come to a certain school. It on the books has been prohibited to be used. It is prohibited to use those deals as an inducement for coming to a school. That's at the highest level. And then as a byproduct of that, making offers to recruits, negotiating those NIL deals, those name, image, and likeness commercial deals with the recruits prior to enrollment has also been prohibited. The simple idea being if folks are allowed, if boosters, collectives, coaches, or anybody else is allowed to make an offer to a recruit, either a high school recruit or an athlete on a different team, and negotiate that deal, that is going to necessarily lend itself and lead to it being an inducement, which is what the NCAA, or one of the things the NCAA is trying to prohibit. That notion of making an offer or negotiating a deal prior to enrollment is now allowed for anybody who doesn't work for a university.
And the reason that the recruiting inducements were prohibited was, as you mentioned, the NCAA didn't want NIL being part of sort of the equation that a school or a third party can say, hey, come to state school X and we'll give you this amount of money in NIL. Instead, the NIL rules were designed to say, look, every other student on campus can make money off of YouTube videos and doing advertisements and commercials. You should be able to be treated the same way. And so in theory, it was once you get to campus, you can do whatever NIL deal you want, just like every other student. But they weren't supposed to use the NIL deals to lure you to campus. But then in practice with the collectives and other boosters, it was clearly being used to induce athletes to come to particular schools. And boosters weren't really hiding that. But it was still against the NCAA rules and against a lot of state laws. And in the Tennessee case, there was a challenge because Tennessee had been investigated for potential violations of NCAA bylaws. And the district court judge said, yeah, you can't stop collectives and third parties from negotiating these deals before they go to school, because it doesn't make sense. If you allow them once they're at the school, why not allow it before they go to school? That springs chaos and pandemonium and people running over the place and headlines saying that this is the end of the NCAA. This is the start of pay for play. This is it. It's over. Can you talk a little bit about some of the more sort of nuance that comes from the actual opinion versus some of the headlines we've seen? And this is not unique to college sports, but people are very quick to judge things and make sweeping pronouncements because they want to be first, and often at the expense of accuracy. Can you talk a little bit about what sort of has been misunderstood or misreported?
Ruling? You're absolutely right that the immediate reaction to this ruling was that the NCAA is dead and the sky is falling. I'm going to say two things that are going to sound like speaking out of both sides of my mouth, but I'm just speaking out the front of my mouth. The first thing is that this order issued by the Tennessee judge is actually very narrow. And it's a quarter step or an eighth of a step toward the many steps that would need to take place for the NCAA to quote unquote be dead, or even this to be pay for play. This is not pay for play. In fact, in the order that the judge specifically, my dog trying to get out of my office. Give me 1 second.
We'll be right back.
Go ahead. All right. In fact, on that dramatic pause, the judge actually explicitly said that the other rules, including the prohibition on pay-for-play, are still in place. So this is not pay-for-play. There's a headline, at least one that I read, that is pay-for-play is here, like literally a headline, which is just isn't true. And I think, well, we're not going to go, I'm not going to run a tangent about sports Twitter or Twitter in general and the need to be first but not right. But so what this ruling does is very narrow. However, the second thing that is going to sound like I'm completely speaking out of both sides of my mouth or saying something opposite is I do think that this ruling is symbolic of a greater issue. And I also think it's the beginning of it's going to lead to practical outcomes on campuses and how coaches work with collectives, that there's going to be a distinction without a difference between collectives talking to athletes or recruits and making offers. And the coaches are now just that much closer to it. And and we're getting really close to pay for NIL, if not pay for play, meaning schools paying directly for NIL. And then the next step would be pay for play. So I think it's a narrow ruling that is actually going to be leading toward the Chicken Little scenarios that we're seeing in the headlines or on Twitter.
And is it fair to say that in reality, many schools or some schools, some collectives were already doing the thing that this order says that they are allowed to do, that collectives were pretty brazenly and openly?
I think most were. I think most were. Most collectives, which are booster organizations, groups of boosters around a school coming together who aren't employed by the aren't employed by the school, they come together, they put in a bunch of money, and then they pay the athletes. Most of them were in some way, shape, or form communicating with recruits. And then the question was, how far are they going? Are they actually making an offer? Are they educating on what athletes before them made? Hey, if you come here, all our offensive linemen made $10 last year, so do the math, you might make $10. Or are they saying you're going to make $10 if you come here? But most of the collectives were already doing that. I think why this is significant, though, is because they have full immunity, at least from the NCAA, in engaging in this. So it's going to become a race to the top, or who can be loudest, who can be biggest in these offers.
So they are now free to do this publicly, openly, boast about it, really do full court press, whatever your analogy is, on athletes. In some ways, though, the schools that felt like they couldn't do it or their collectives couldn't do it because the NCAA rules didn't allow it were looking at other collectives that were doing it and saying, hey, why can't we do that? And those that were a little maybe wearier of violating NCAA bylaws, now at least it could all be on the same playing field, at least, or all playing by the same rules or lack of rules. So
but the crux of the issue is still missed in that communication between the coaches, the decision makers, the coaches, the ADs, the sport administrators of the schools, the folks who are going to be deciding rosters. Who's going to be on my roster? Who do I want on my roster? And how badly do I want him and her on my roster? AKA, how much should we spend of our budget? Those decision makers are still prohibited from engaging in this activity. So there may be a level playing field a little bit with the collectives, but this ruling does not impact the folks on campus, the folks who are making the decisions on who's in the roster and how badly do I want him or her on the roster, from making those offers. So what it does is I think the more risk tolerant schools are still going to be significantly, quote unquote, ahead when it comes to making offers that they can put in front of a recruit, and other schools who are more conservative, less risk tolerant, more conservative are still not going to be comfortable doing. And we work with schools on all ends of that spectrum. So I hear this from coaches using compliance directors at all these different schools.
All right. So let's get to that in one second, but before we get there, just to put a finer point on it or to emphasize, what's that expression?
An uglier point?
To put a thicker point on it, this is an NIL decision. This says that in the past, you could, under NCAA rules, give an NIL deal if you're a collective and negotiate an NIL deal after they've already enrolled, after they're on campus, after they've decided to go to that school, but you couldn't do it as recruiting inducement. You could do it before. Now it's saying you can do it collectives, third parties, whenever you want. But still NIL, still can't do pay for performance, still have to be quid pro quo. Yeah. And so the fundamentals of the NCAA rules are still in place that NIL compensation is permitted. Now, this is expanding when that NIL compensation can be given or negotiated, but it's still limited to NIL. And by the way, one other point I wanted to mention earlier, you have a lot of experience working in the NFL and the NFLPA. The idea that you can't use NIL to recruit an athlete, the pro leagues have that rule. Now, of course, that's collectively bargained for, so you know, it doesn't raise antitrust issues. But I think people are sometimes in their haste to provide college athletes with more rights, which I think we both are very much supportive of giving college athletes everything they can get and everything they deserve. But even at the pro level, there are limitations on how NIL can be used. And it's designed to be for third parties to pay them for the value of their right of publicity, of their name and likeness. And it's clearly not been used that way in many cases for college sports. And this will open the door for that even more. But in terms of like the line that the NCAA is still trying to draw, the line is still there. That NIL, okay, paying just to attend the school or to play at the school, not okay. Now, is it easy to make it look like the pay to attend the school is an NIL deal? Yes, but at least for now, there are still restrictions that it has to be, again, at least in theory, for NIL.
Yes, it's the same restriction consequence, but as you mentioned, the whole collectively bargained piece is the piece that's missing in college. Obviously, that is the problem, which leads to all the antitrust issues. One of the things you mentioned, pay for play and pay for performance are still both prohibited. You mentioned that quid pro quo is still required. And then the third one is that schools are still prohibited from directly compensating athletes for NIL, which I think is important. I've seen a few Twitter experts talking about...
Well, if we call it X, they can just be experts.
That's what I said, experts. I didn't put no E in the word expert. Did you hear that? I went really quickly to the X part of the word, expert. But I've also seen this out there that schools can now pay athletes for, and that's just not true at this point. Although I do think that's the next domino to fall at some point, which is schools paying directly for NIL, which call it pay for NIL, which is right on the doorstep or the back door or the window, maybe, of pay for play. So those are the three things that are still intact and still enforceable. And I don't think you want to get into the jurisdictional question that we spent a lot of time discussing. And the other thing is what schools should be doing, I think, is maybe even more practical.
So let's do that. This decision comes down Friday, late afternoon, early evening, and you have many schools, including many Power 5 or Power 4 schools, that are looking to you for guidance on how to run their NIL operations and what they can and can't do and what they need to be telling their athletes, their coaches, their boosters, their collectives. And so you've got to take this judicial opinion written by one district court judge who is not necessarily intimately familiar with college sports or the impact this is going to have. And you've got to translate that to all of these clients you're working with. So tell us how that fire drill works. You get that decision Friday and then have to push things out to...
Yeah, I'll start with today's Monday, and I did not boost my candidacy for husband or dad of the year over the weekend because I spent most of the weekend on the phone, and that's not complaining. It's just the nature of the business.
Were you running for that? Is that...
No, you get nominated, actually. John Entz nominated me.
Okay.
John Entz. No, so we were on a call. Actually, interesting timing. I just got hung up a call pitching a Power 5 school, a very large football school that we don't currently work with. And as soon as we clicked leave or end or hung up, how about that? Hung up on Zoom. This came down. And so the first thing we did is we got on as a team, as an executive team, to level set, take a breath. And then I looked at my phone and it was getting blown up by text messages and calls from ADs. And I don't look, one, we purport to have the most thoughtful and accurate and real-time guidance in sports. So, of course, our clients, our ADs and the folks, deputy ADs and other folks on campus should call us. And two, the world doesn't work. This is with all due respect to lawyers and law professors, Professor Feldman. But the law works at a certain pace, and even the NCAA works at a certain pace, and college athletics and coaches work at a significantly faster pace.
Very disrespectful.
Friday afternoon, this opinion comes out. Today's Monday, so it was about 3 days ago. Do the math, Gabe. 3 times 24. Ready? How many hours is that, Gabe?
72.
And in that time, I know for a fact firsthand that schools and coaches have had discussions happening in recruiting that they needed to make a decision on how involved are they going to be and how involved are they not going to be. So our job to answer your question, first we sent out a communication to all of our schools, 42, I believe at this point, 42 D1 schools, many of them Power Five, where we identified the top three issues we identified that needed to be answered without the answers. Those three were jurisdiction. Where does this apply? Does it apply in Tennessee? Does it only apply in the Eastern District of Tennessee? Does it apply everywhere? Second one was state laws. How is this going to interact with state laws? And the third one is something we've already talked about, which is what impact does this have on institutional involvement, aka does this change what coaches can do? So we laid that out. We said to everybody, be calm. We got you. We'll be back soon. Laid out those three issues on Friday night late, and then spent the weekend doing two things. One, answering those questions, which happy to talk about here. And two, doing what I think is more important than some jurisdictional analysis about nationwide injunctions, which I think is fascinating. In an intellectual exercise, sitting there talking about should it or should it not apply in other states. But what's more practical is, okay, so what do we need to do? If I'm an AD, what do I need to do today on Monday? And what do I need to do by the end of the week? And what do I need to do by the end of the month? And we identified three things that all the schools, all AD, all Division Ones, frankly, all schools, but our schools are all D1, should be doing. And then we gave our reasoning for those three recommended action items.
Okay, so let's talk about that first one, the scope of the injunction and whether this applies beyond the Eastern District of Tennessee or beyond Tennessee and Virginia, that were the plaintiffs. And again, there's disagreement been expressed on whether this automatically applied to the whole country or this only applied much more narrowly. And where do you land just on the sort of what it means practically speaking? Because like you said, most people in the country, certainly athletic directors who just want to be able to tell their coaches that minute what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to, don't want to read a 20-page memo on the scope of injunctions and whether this automatically applies or whether you have to worry about what some court in New York might do and what happens when there's a conflict. They don't care about that. They want to know what the answer is. And so how do you frame the answer for them when there's, in this case, again, I think a pretty complex legal issue.
Yeah. From a legal perspective, it's not only complex, it's actually really fascinating because these nationwide injunctions over the last decade have been heavily debated and contested over some really important issues like Obamacare and immigration and transgender issues and abortion. And so it's actually really interesting. But again, like you said, for the practical application for these ADs, they just want to know, if I'm not in Tennessee or Virginia, does this apply to me? And if it doesn't, holy smokes, I'm behind or I can't do what those schools can. And if it does, okay, great, let's go do it. And how do we do it? But from a practical perspective, the way we looked at it, putting aside the complicated nature of the application of civil procedure from one federal court to other federal courts, it was, okay, so the NCAA would be put in a position of one, having to test the precedential with a C effect of this order nationwide. And two, they would have, that would be the first risk. The second one would be, even if they took that risk and another federal court or another federal judge happened to agree with them that the injunction in Tennessee didn't apply in another state, Ohio, California, wherever, it'd still be persuasive. So they could still lose that case on its merits, meaning they could get sued by another AG or another party for antitrust violations if they brought a case against these schools. And then third, by doing that, the NCAA itself would be creating unequal playing field for Tennessee and Virginia. So because of those three things, our recommendation to schools was to proceed as if this is a nationwide, has the nationwide effect, until we hear if from the NCAA that they're taking the position otherwise, I don't think that they will take the position otherwise for those three reasons. So that was a jurisdictional issue.
And on that note, similar sort of thing happened with the transfer case in West Virginia. Attorney General and the NCAA did issue, I think it was 5 days after that, ruling guidance to the school saying we're suspending our transfer rules. And we don't have guidance from the NCAA yet, other than what Charlie Baker sent to the membership earlier today, February 26th. And do you want to just summarize what that says? And it's consistent with what you just laid out, but do you want to just say what the guidance?
Yeah, he effectively said, we know that you schools, member institutions, want clarity. We hear you, we understand, but we are doing our diligence to get you that clarity, and we will issue new guidance or our position in short order. And so there's still today, again, February 26th, we're still in a position of not knowing where the NCAA stands, and our schools hire us to put them in a position to, even in this purgatory state of not having a clear position from the NCAA, of at the very least having the factors to weigh when making a decision on where they want to be in the spectrum of engaging with their collective or advising or endorsing a collective that is going out and making offers. But, and that's one thing I was going to say earlier is collectives are third parties. So it's groups, boosters and groups of boosters. In theory, a collective could go and take its own interpretation, irrespective of the school's interpretation of this opinion. The collectives that do the best and are most effective are the ones that are aligned directly with the athletic department and the university. So a lot of these collectives, the good ones, turn to the AD and they say, how do you want me to proceed? And so but it's an important distinction that even if an AD, in theory, an AD could say, here's our interpretation of this, this doesn't apply or it does apply, or here's how we want our communication to work. And the collective could say, we're good. We're actually going to do it how somebody else is down the road or in another state.
And then you would also, though, be advising the athletic department to educate the athletes that if a collective gets in touch with you to try to convince you to transfer, or if it's somebody that they're recruiting, that's where it would be relevant for the school more directly is the athletes they're dealing with.
The athletes and the coaches both, yeah. And it's certainly the athletes on, not necessarily what this means for them, because I don't know how many athletes are following these cases like the GCs are, or we are, but it is, to your point, if you get contacted, here are the things you should be aware of. And you give them one or two things to just look out for. And yeah, that leads to another thing, which this ruling actually leads to, interestingly, is now these collectives are, and I'm getting off track from our three things, but now these collectives are able to, not only are they able to offer hard and fast contracts, and by hard and fast, enforceable contracts, but I would argue, like, some of the education of the athletes is you should be asking for this now. Because if a collective is unwilling to provide you an enforceable agreement, above board open air agreement, now that it's allowed or not prohibited, why aren't they?
And now you can, if you have an agent or not, you can actually use one offer as leverage against another offer, which in theory you weren't allowed to do now.
Which goes back to earlier about the two sides of my mouth, which I was saying this is very narrow, but I think it has it's a step in the direction of something very big and a big overhaul or a massive change of college athletics. That's why, because now it's becoming more formalized. The entire process of negotiating and having two offers, financial offers from two different schools and comparing them and leveraging them, it is becoming more formalized. And the more formalized that becomes, the more this looks like pro sports.
Yeah. And it'll also be, again, without any rules around reporting or disclosure or transparency, I would think we're going to see some very large numbers, even larger than we've seen floated out there by whether it's the athlete or the family or an agent, and just to get more leverage to say collective, if you want,
they can, for that school. Because they can't, because they're not going to be punished for that. And before Friday afternoon, there was risk at least of being punished. Now, practically, were they going to? I don't know. But at least there was the looming threat of a possibility of being punished as an athlete and having to sit out if you talked about your engagement with a negotiation with a third party, aka a collective.
Before we get to state law, just to wrap up on the NCAA issue, one reason why the NCAA probably won't, we don't know for sure until they issue their guidance, but probably would apply this nationally to say every school, every athlete, every collective is subject to the same rules as the Tennessee order, is because that's been the number one thing the NCAA has preached over the last 100 years is they need uniformity. Everybody has to be subject to the same rules. And so if Tennessee and maybe Virginia athletes aren't subject to these rules or their schools aren't, then they're not going to subject these other states to. So that's the sort of the practical one. And then the legal one is if they do try to crack down on recruiting inducements through NIL in other states, then they'll get sued again. And so I think that both practically and legally, they're trying to minimize any new lawsuits, and that would just invite further litigation. So I think, that, again, we don't have the official word from the NCAA yet. All we have is Charlie Baker saying they're looking at this. They will give more guidance. But then there is still state law. The states that rushed to pass laws because they didn't want to fall behind in giving athletes that might come to their schools have NIL opportunities. Talk about how the state laws may still, at least in theory, be something that athletes, schools, others need to keep an eye on.
Yeah, yeah. If you assume a state law that is on the books and is actually a law is important, some of these laws, including the one in Tennessee, could be problematic. And the judge noted this in his order. He noted specifically the Tennessee state law prohibits some of this activity that NCAA is now enjoined from prohibiting, which sounds super strange, but the judge noted that some of the athletes or recruits or potential athletes in the state of Tennessee might go to other states that either don't have laws, or go to schools located in other states that don't have laws or don't have laws that don't prohibit it like Tennessee's does. But there's a super funky scenario in Tennessee, for example, where you have something prohibited by state law that's now not able to be enforced or prohibited by the NCAA. And if an athlete were to engage in it, the only the entity that would enforce the state law is the AG, the Attorney General, who brought the lawsuit originally. So I think practically speaking, again, that at least in that state, I'm not speaking on behalf of them, they are a client, but just my own interpretation would be that I think that they're probably fine given their alignment with the AG. But if you look at the other state laws, there are a lot of state laws with language that mirrored the original language from the NCAA. One of those prongs in that language was a prohibition on inducements and a prohibition on using NIL as an inducement to come to a school, making offers. So now you have this conflict with a lot of these state laws with this ruling, which now opens up the door to third parties doing this. And now in some places it's a violation of the state law potentially. And I think what's going to happen is another rush to state houses to amend those laws. And we LDS are at the center of having those conversations. Even as of Saturday morning, I was on with an AD about having this conversation with the government relations group and GC on his campus to let's go really quickly before the state legislature ends its session to get this amended.
And it's, again, ironic that the states that didn't pass the NIL laws are in the best position because they didn't have the restrictions to begin with. And in some cases, they were more restrictive than NCAA rules and now are more restrictive than potentially than this.
Yeah. And I think this is, here's my futurist hat on. I think this is going to happen again. I think it's going to happen again and again. And in fact, probably more than once. We talked earlier about pay for NIL, meaning schools directly compensating athletes for the name, image, and likeness. If and when that becomes not able to be prohibited by the NCAA, aka allowed, now you're going to have the state laws again. And then you're going to have the last one, the final frontier, or so they say, Gabe, is pay for play. And pay for play or pay for performance is prohibited in a lot of these state laws, most of them. And the moment there's the ability to pay an athlete for his or her performance or to play his or her sport, you're going to have this same state law issue.
Yeah, I think space is the final frontier.
Right? Is it though? Because we don't actually know what comes after space.
Yeah, but it's probably.
I mentioned this earlier. Time could be the final frontier.
Yeah, but not pay for play. We agree that pay for play isn't the final frontier. Let me just.
Are our deceased celebrities currently famous? Yes or no?
Yes.
Currently.
Yes.
Is Elvis famous or was Elvis famous? All right.
Oh, he is famous and he was famous.
Is he?
Wait, but to come back to. One thing I think is interesting about the state laws. Two things. One, this is the NCAA's argument all along, is we can't just be at the whim of what a state legislature decides to do in a given session. And then we have to adjust our rules based on what they're allowing or not allowing. And then two is from the most aggressive progressive states, you think about that first pass their NIL laws, California first and then Florida, even those really progressive, aggressive ones, all they agreed on, not that this wasn't significant, but all they agreed on was to prohibit the NCAA from prohibiting NIL compensation, not to prohibit the NCAA from prohibiting pay for play. And I don't know. I certainly know that if Florida allows it, then Alabama is going to want to allow it, and Georgia is going to want to allow it, and they're not going to fall behind in terms of pay for play. But when the states had their opportunity to say, we want to create law to protect college athletes, they weren't willing to go pay for play. They were only willing to go NIL. And so, again, coming back to where we started, that NIL versus pay for play line is still there. Right? It may be blurred, it may be muddied, it may be hard to enforce, but I still don't know if you'll get unanimity in state legislatures in saying we want to provide the right for college athletes to be paid as opposed to paid for their NIL.
Upon state by state level, I agree. And I was part of many of those conversations with our school partners and their counterparts in government affairs. And in some cases, even the staff members on the legislators' teams who were drafting these. And I vividly remember multiple conversations about what me throwing out the notion that you don't want it this to be, you want this to be overly liberal and then let the schools make the decisions and give them the parameter to make the decision. So you should allow pay for play in the state law, and then the school's policy will prohibit it because it's going to be aligned with the current NCAA policy. And the response in at least two states that I specifically remember was, this will never get passed because we have traditionalists who are on our state legislature who believe in college athletics and amateurism. And I think that's it's not a throwaway comment. I think that's a very legitimate practical hurdle to pay for play, which is the lawmakers in these states, and especially the ones in the South, a lot of them they like amateurism. They like college sports the way that it is.
And I think there are still judges who agree with that. Not this judge. Actually, I shouldn't say that. Maybe this judge does. Because
the judge opened up
was NIL. We've certainly seen indications Justice Kavanaugh might think that pay for play should be permitted. But I just think the death knell for athlete compensation restrictions is maybe being talked about a little prematurely. I do think there is still a long way to go before athletes across the board have a right to be paid, period. Now, we might see it expedited by conferences deciding to do it because they see the writing on the wall. But this is how we started. Pay for play is still prohibited. You might say only in name only. In practice, people are just doing whatever they want. But I still think there's an opportunity for the NCAA to win some of these cases down the road. They may be underdogs at this point, and they were always huge favorites prior to that. But I just think there is some life left, not only in the NCAA as a governing body, but also in terms of being able to put some restrictions on college athletes, despite
all
evidence to the contrary so far.
In addition to the legal reasons why pay for play still has a fighting chance, I think there's an economic... an economic argument for each one of these locales. And by locales, the school and the boosters and the collectives and the donors and the alumni and all the people around an institution, I don't think it's unlimited. Like, people talk about these big time football programs like the money is unlimited. And I can tell you firsthand, after working with many of them, many of the collectives and many of the ADs, that they're not. So if there's some type of a limit cap, and I know there's a cap is like a dirty word without bargaining, but it could be a legislative cap, or it could be a response to litigation, an opinion, the Claudia Wilkin Alston number. If there's some version of a cap for pay for play, let's just use the number $10 million. $10 million goes to, and Charlie Baker had this in his proposal. There was the calculation about how much the athletes are going to get paid for this separate subdivision. Let's just say it's $10 million. You're naturally creating a cap. You're gonna naturally create a cap on NIL, or a natural, if not a cap, a band for each locale, each school that is going to go into a band of dollars that's not going to be exceeded by most schools because they're just not going to have enough money. So if there's $10 million going for pay for play, there's going to be wiggle room for NIL, but it's not going to be 100.
Right. And the other point, obviously, we need to mention is we're talking about this from an antitrust perspective, and because that's what the Tennessee case is about, and now just a general economic perspective. The employment issues obviously might just make all of this moot to an extent, that it doesn't matter whether it's illegal or not under antitrust law. If they're employees under FLSA, then they have a right to minimum wage, and under NLRB, they have a right to unionize. And so that could obviously change everything. And we're maybe headed down that path more quickly than down the antitrust path, but I have multiple paths here. And our path, Casey, ends now. So let's close this part of the conversation, Casey, with practical recommendations that you're giving to schools.
Yeah. So we talked about the fire drill on Friday. We sent out a communication to all of our schools late Friday night saying, one, be patient, turn off Twitter. Please don't follow Twitter as your advice. And two, here are the three key issues that we've identified. We'll be back Sunday night. So last night late, we sent out another email, which clarified those three points, which we just talked about, and gave three very direct recommendations. And I wanted to go as far as giving like assignment dates for all of our schools, and I was overruled by our much smarter executive team at Altius. But I think the first one has to happen fast, which is educate your coaches and educate your coaches on what this means and what this doesn't mean and what this changes and what this does not change. Importantly, what it doesn't change is you coach are not now, or you are not allowed to make NIL offers now.
You're still not allowed.
You are not allowed. You're prohibited from, just like you were before, making NIL offers and negotiating NIL deals. Coach. Now a lot of coaches are doing it. They're doing it or they're fully doing it, but that doesn't change the fact. This ruling doesn't change the fact that you're still not allowed to do that. So for the coaches that want to follow the rules, or at the very least know what the rules are, if they're going to break them, that's the first thing you need to do as an AD, like this morning. And I wanted to say, you need to do today. You need to do that. By the end of the week, you need to educate your athletes on what this means, what they might be hearing from collectives from around the country, and what's above board and what's not. So that was number one, is educate your coaches and the athletes. The second one is, I do think we're at a point now where the collectives are so important to the success of a program through retention and recruiting of athletes that you need to have a formalized process as how you communicate as a school with the collective. So who's communicating? Who's the primary contact? When the collective needs information about a roster, needs information about a transfer portal window that's coming up on March 18th for men's and women's basketball, who is he or she at the collective getting that information from? And it's time to formalize that for practical reasons, because it's going to make it more efficient and you're going to hopefully be more successful. And for legal reasons, preemptively defensive reasons, if you ever get investigated. So that was number two. And the third one is, we talked about this a little bit, but taking a close look at your state law, because in short order, there are going to be states changing their laws, and we know who's going to be behind those changes. It's going to be the state next door who is recruiting, or their collective is making offers on kids in your state. So I don't mean that as a fear tactic. This isn't fear mongering. It's really not in the world of you're going to get behind, but these state laws are going to be changed. And if you have a state law standing in your way, it's just one more reason for somebody to tell you as a coach or you as an AD to tell you, no, you can't do that. And that's not a good position to be in.
And then fourth piece of advice is
always wear sunscreens. I've been reading with my 2-year-old a book called Elephant and Piggy. Have you ever heard of this book?
Of course, by Williams? Yeah. Yeah.
It's fantastic. So there's a book called Going on a Drive.
I love it.
Drive, 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 drive. So I also, here's some more rules. If you're going to go on a drive, bring a map, bring sunglasses because it might be sunny, and bring an umbrella because it might.
Yeah, it might also be sunny. But
and then bring a car. So at the end of that story, they don't have a car.
Right.
And so then they end up improvising and they play pirate with the sunglasses out over one eye. And then I think it's...
Spoiler alert for those who haven't read it yet. But
sorry.
Okay. To sum everything up.
In Inception,
is it fair?
They were dead the whole time.
Is it fair to say that college sports is in a distressed state?
I think college sports has never been healthier. If you look at the ratings, if you look at from college football, which everybody talks about, to women's basketball, to the volleyball game that Nebraska hosted, to what Caitlin Clark's doing in women's basketball, to what Patty Gasso's built in softball at Oklahoma, and then the list goes on. College sports is thriving. All of these legal, the legislative, judicial issues, these the expansion of athletes' rights from commercial to employment and quasi-employment are certainly not slowing down people's appetite for watching college athletics. And as long as people want to watch it and the athletes want to play, I think we're going to have a very healthy ecosystem. And there's my positive note of the day, Gabe.
That's a great positive note. We're going to stop there on that note. The second part is going to be about private equity, which is, I thought I was teeing it up well to say that private equity come in when they see a distressed industry, but instead you use
equity. Oh, look, I hope this part doesn't get cut out. No, let's leave this part in. So look, economically distressed industry with more expenses going out, for sure. We're going to talk about that. Going back in time, I mentioned time is relative, but for anybody, for the two people who are now listening, because I'm sure Abby stopped listening at this point, for your kids that are listening, distressed industry from an economic standpoint, sure. But from an overall industry, incredibly healthy industry that will survive, and it's going to look very different, I think, in 5 years, but it's still going to survive, and we're still going to have championships on primetime.
Okay. Perfect spot to end this part of the conversation. Thank you, Casey. That was surprisingly insightful and interesting. And the second part of our conversation will be about the potential influx of private equity into college sports and what that might mean. But let's end the NIL and Tennessee conversation here. So thank you, Casey, for coming on to discuss this part of it.
Thank you for having me again.